Before we wait for the slides to arrive, I'd like to first of all say how pleased I am to be here. Thank you to Upendra and the other organisers for inviting me. I very much appreciate it. It's always, for those of us on the other side of the Atlantic, it's always good to come to this meeting and you can have a room full of people, of experts in the field for half a day or so. So thank you. Presentation, as you can see, is a joint effort with myself and colleagues at Rothamsted and also with Chris Van Kessel. You'll see why a bit later. I'll make a big statement, which I think is fairly clear, is that in order to achieve global food security, in many parts of the world, a lot more nitrogen fertiliser is going to have to be used in one way or another. Okay, there are some places where a bit less needs to be used, but globally, use has got to go up. And that's fine, but of course, larger inputs do mean that there's a bigger risk of nitrogen being lost. And on average, it's thought that about half of the nitrogen that's used in the world now actually is lost. So there's big challenges there. And there are other papers where people have estimated the extra amount of nitrogen that's going to be needed, with certain assumptions about food production. So here's one example of some places where extra nitrogen is sure needed, taken from some work by Bernard van Lauver, IITA, in these two regions of sub-Saharan Africa. Local agronomists have done experiments and worked out recommended rates of nitrogen for maize. Of course, they're quite useless. The farmers can't afford the nitrogen. But they reckon that they need 60 or 100 kilograms of N per hectare to get reasonable yields. And the actual rates are around 2 kilograms. So you can see there is scope for some increases. So where's this extra nitrogen going to come from? Well, in part, clearly, it will come from just extra nitrogen fertiliser being used. But that carries big issues because, of course, the environmental impacts of nitrogen, especially the greenhouse gas emissions associated with its manufacture and its use, direct and indirect. Secondly, I think there's huge scope for more efficient use of N fertiliser. I'll come to that later. I think there's a huge scope for more efficient use of nitrogen from organic sources, and also for use of biological nitrogen fixation. And I'm going to, first of all, spend a little bit of time thinking about the more off-the-wall approaches before coming back to some more run-of-the-mill end-use efficiency sort of considerations. So one radical approach, which has got a lot of publicity in recent days, and there are some quite big funding projects for this, is to do genetic modification to get biological nitrogen fixation into non-legumes. This is very exciting science. It's not science that I know about. I'm not expert on that at all. It's clearly going to be a long journey. Now, Chairman Mao in China said that every long journey has a first step. So great, I'm glad that people are making that first step. But I do have a few, I think there are some caveats. I have some concern that some of the big funders might think that because they're funding that first step, they haven't got to worry about anything else to do with nitrogen. That one can be ticked off. But it is going to be a long journey. So I think in the meantime, and the meantime could be quite a few decades, I would guess, we do need a bit of some improved agronomy research on using nitrogen. And also some technical points about this. It seems to me fairly obvious that if you're diverting photosynthate into the roots or the nodules of these new nitrogen-fixing plants, that's going to detract from the grain yield. Now, in some situations, that might be okay, but if you then wanted to top up with nitrogen fertilizer, presumably that would then switch off or inhibit the biological fixation. So I think there are some issues to be considered there. Another way of using legumes is to intercrop, and these pictures are taken in Kenya. And some of you may be aware that this very, very good international institute in Kenya, ICP, have been intercropping a South American legume, Desmodium, between the rows of the maize plant, because there's a lot of space between rows of maize plants. They are doing it for pest control reasons, because of chemical signalling. The chemicals from the Desmodium repels certain insect pests. But of course, it's fixing nitrogen, and there is now work going on to look at that benefit of that approach. Another approach, it would be to breed crops with larger root systems so you could explore the soil profile and use whatever nitrates there better. This has been mooted very much in the context of carbon sequestration to get more carbon into the soil. I think there's some questions about that. But one would expect that if you could select plants like that, you would be exploring the soil better, probably using soil-derived N rather better. Another idea is to breed perennial versions of current crops, and indeed there are sessions on that at this conference. And again, you would expect that because those crops are not started with no roots at all, they've got some start every year, you would expect them to use any nitrogen in the profile rather better. But again, this is another long breeding journey, and the website of one of the organisations that was keen on it said it was a promise requiring patience. Recycling of manures, I'm not going to dwell on this, but there are loads of people who know much more about this than I do. But for example, spreading slurry on the soil surface leads to big ammonia volatilization losses, and there is gadgetry. This is one version that's used in the UK called a trailing shoe, which cuts down on that ammonia loss, and there's injection systems and so on as well. And here's one very nice paper from China drawing attention to the very large amounts of manure that are there, and some of my colleagues who've worked there, they've estimated that all of the vast amount of manure in China contains, I think, 14 million tonnes of nitrogen, which is equivalent to about half of the total fertiliser nitrogen used. Now, you're not going to utilise all of it, but even a small bit of that will be worth having. Right, now let's come back to some issues to do with fertiliser use efficiency directly. I want to show you some examples of the efficiency or inefficiency of use of nitrogen in a few situations. This is often to do with matching crop needs, taking account of nitrogen from other sources, and getting the timing right. Now, here's some data from Chris Van Kessel's group from, say, here in California. I think it's about 600 kilometres away, so not that near. But it's rice in California, and they were looking at nitrogen recovery after different management practices affecting the rice. And the yellow bars are the recovery in above-ground crop using N15, and they're looking at about 40% recovery of the applied N, or a bit less in some cases. A sort of moderate, not great, but it could be worse, I suppose. The blue-purple bars show the same thing measured using the nitrogen difference, the extra N in a fertilised crop compared to a control, not using N15 at all. And there's a whole can of worms there that I'm not going to open up today as to why difference method and N15 give you different answers. It's kind of well known, but sometimes it's ignored and can cause confusion. In fact, the reason for using N15 is not so much for measuring crop recovery directly, but it's really if you want to know how much of your nitrogen is being retained in the soil, so you get the overall recovery and hence the total loss. Then, of course, you can follow the fate of what's in the soil as well. And here's some data where we've done that. This is stuff I've done with my group in the UK quite some time ago. We applied N15 to field-grown crops in plots in the field. This is one example where the winter wheat given nitrogen at a reasonable rate at a reasonable time. 63% of that nitrogen was recovered in the crop, but another 20% retained in the soil in organic forms, not inorganic nitrate, and loss of about 17%. But if you compare that, the one on the left, with the same sort of winter wheat crop, but one that was not healthy, it was damaged by root disease, the uptake was much less, the retention in soil was rather bigger because the crop was not such a good sink, and the losses were more or less double. So there are big and important lessons there for getting the agronomy right and making sure that you're growing your crops in the best way if you want the nitrogen to be used efficiently. And this slide, again, summarises some data from a lot of N15 field experiments that we did. These are with winter wheat. We did other ones. And again, on average, with all these, we found that recovery in above-ground crop was about 68%, which is pretty high. There was a big range, depending on environment, almost twofold range. But around 20% retained in the soil, we commonly found that. And then, so the losses on average were 13%, but went from almost nothing to about a third. And these losses, we found, were often quite closely correlated with the rainfall soon after applying the nitrogen. And in our case, we think that's mostly due to denitrification, not leaching. So, and you can't do much about that, but you could use that relationship to adjust split applications, I think. if you insist on applying nitrogen at a silly time, you'll get big losses. In the UK, it used to be common for our farmers to apply some nitrogen at sowing time to winter wheat, autumn sown, fall sown wheat. But the crop doesn't grow much during the winter. It's not a good sink for nitrogen. We get leaching throughout the winter, and so 40 to 80% of that nitrogen is lost. Literally, it goes down the drain, and that's actually not done at all now. It's pretty much banned by law. Okay, another example of nitrogen recovery. This is in the US. It's a nice paper from Nebraska. 32 trials looking at irrigated maize. This is nitrogen by difference method. The mean recovery by the crop in these experiments was about 64%. But there was a range. If you gave a rather higher amount, you got bigger losses. But overall, if you use an economically sensible rate of N, the efficiency of use of that nitrogen, shown by this partial factor productivity, was really pretty good compared to other situations that I've seen. I now want to turn to tropical situations, because I think it's actually harder to use nitrogen efficiently there than it is in the temperate ones. So this is some work that, again, Chris Van Kessel and I were deeply involved with. We helped to plan together with people in 13 locations around the world, and we put N15 on various crops in various cropping systems and followed it over up to 6 cropping seasons. And sorry, it's rather small letters, but that's a summary of the results, if you like, but just for the first cropping season. The main point was to actually look longer, but I'm not looking at that now. So you can see the mean recovery of the nitrogen in all of those systems there was only 33%. Not great at all, it seems to me. And with perhaps one exception, the rates of nitrogen were not excessive either. So they're quite modest rates of nitrogen, but only 33% recovered in that first crop. Huge range. You see the sugarcane in Brazil did the best, but in one of the Chile sites, only 7% recovery. We actually ascribe that to think the fact that for various agronomic reasons, that site had a lot of mineral nitrate in the soil before we started, and that appeared to have been taken up preferentially to the fertiliser. Perhaps that was an odd one. There was another pretty low one in Malaysia where there was very heavy rain just straight after applying the nitrogen, and that cut the recovery and increased the losses. Again, a few other sort of summaries from this piece of work. We found that on average, about 35% of the applied nitrogen fertiliser was retained in the soil, immobilised in organic form. Some of that will be in the roots, but some was in microbial biomass. So that's getting on for twice the proportion that we commonly find immobilised in temperate regions. So again, it looks as if the warmer temperature is causing those microbes to work fast and immobilise some of that nitrogen before the crop can get it. And so that's one of the reasons why I think it's harder to get nitrogen use efficiency higher in tropical regions. And again, we found, on average, in that first growing season, about 35% of the applied N was lost from the crop and the soil system. Again, tend to be rather higher than we see in temperate regions on the whole. Okay, right, this old, thorny old question that's been around for as long as I've been working, probably for as long as I've been born, but I didn't know about it then. How much nitrogen do you apply? Too little or too much, and both have got disadvantages. So when I'm far from home, I like to put up a picture of the Broadbort long-term experiment at Rothamsted. Makes you feel a bit comfortable. Here we are, we have various plots with long-term treatments that include ones that have had different rates of nitrogen applied over many years. And we also have a drainage system. We can measure the nitrate leached from each plot. And here's some data from my colleague Keith Goulding. So we've got the different rates of nitrogen along the bottom here. And along the bottom. And you can see a typical sort of yield plateau. You can identify sort of an economic optimum rate at 140, 150-ish maybe a bit less. No point putting on any more, although in that year you didn't know that. That's the problem. But if you do exceed that amount, these sort of orange bars show you the amount of nitrate leached in the following winter. So as you exceed a sensible amount, basically you're leaving nitrate in the soil, and again, it literally goes down the drain. Now, how to know how much to apply? Now, you know, IPNI and others talk about the four R's, right time, right rate, etc. And that's all very nice and very helpful. But for goodness sake, how do you know what is right in your field this year in your conditions? And it's blooming difficult. There's no two ways about it. So now I just want to talk about ways of trying to help with that. What sort of things have we got around that can help us to know how much nitrogen to give and to use it more efficiently? And there's a whole bunch of prediction systems that try to estimate the supply of N from the soil or other sources. You can measure mineral N in the soil. There are sensing techniques for crops. There are things to do with application methods. For example, in some of the work I was involved with in China, it's very common for urea to be surface applied. And again, huge amounts of it is actually just volatilized. You're looking at 20, 30, sometimes even 40%, I think. So putting it subsurface can make a huge difference. And inhibitors. So I'll give examples, just a few of these. So here's the sort of typical, it's like traditional prediction systems. This is a sort of Bible from the UK, a book of predictions based on past experiments, look-up tables, basically. But there are also interactive electronic version, and there are models that do the same sort of thing. So these are useful. This is a nitrogen budget approach. This is probably the biggest publication I've ever written. This was work in China. And that was a big poster on the wall that was about 2 metres high. I don't know whether it was the biggest impact factor, but it was certainly big. And so we were trying to get the idea to, actually not so much to farmers, but to local agronomic advisors, that you can think of a budget. Okay, the red thing on the side here, this is the amount of nitrogen the crop needs, you'd like to take up, given various assumptions, plus an allowance for losses. And the tendency was for advisors to say, oh, yeah, the maize will take up 300 kilograms, therefore give 300 kilograms. For goodness sake, this isn't right, because the soil and other things will supply some of that, so it's that difference you need to make up. There are, again, around the world, certainly in this country and in Europe and UK, there are quite sophisticated schemes for measuring soil mineral N, and farmers get them sent off, and there are labs that will do a very quick turnaround. This was a very simple in-field version of that we played around with in China using these Merck coloured strips. I used to be a bit sniffy about crop sensing, but I've sort of got more, I've warmed to it somewhat now, because I think there are better opportunities than there used to be. Basically using chlorophyll meters, that sort of thing. And it can be done in different ways. This is a handheld thing that they call the Green Seeker that I've seen demonstrated and used certainly in experiments in India. You've got tractor-mounted things. I'm sure versions of this exist in North America. But also, I think this new drone technology gives the opportunity to sense crops in ways that weren't available in the past. So here's one example for some work, again, done in India with this what's so-called site-specific nutrient management, which basically was a combination of a model to predict your nitrogen requirement plus modified by a chlorophyll meter, done on 56 farm sites. Nice piece of work. And here's some results. You can see that when this combination was used, grain yield went up a bit, the amount of nitrogen could go down a bit, but the efficiency of use and the profit went up a bit. You don't need to have the sophistication of a meter. You can use leaf colour charts. I know that IRI have been very active in developing those. And here's an example of using that, again, in India for rice wheat. So again, when they were used, you could increase your yields for the same nitrogen, but decrease your N2O emissions, or indeed you could give more nitrogen and get a bigger yield, but with no more N2O. Here's an example from China, colleagues in Nanjing, looking at nitrification inhibitors, probably unusually in a way with rice, and again, that could give you the equivalent of an extra 60 kilograms of N per hectare. So that seemed to be pretty useful in this session earlier this morning. There was a lot of positive stuff about inhibitors. So, to draw to an end, I think prediction systems are there and they can be improved. They can be as sophisticated or as simple as you want. I've mentioned application methods, soil min-N. Crop sensing seems to me to be perhaps coming into its own potentially now. Inhibitors seem to have got a lot to offer. I put this one on the end as a bit of a tease, really. Can we really control the remineralisation of immobilised then? I've yet to be convinced, but there's great research there to be done if we can. delivery of that information to farmers is important. And the point made by the keynote speaker last night was there's no reason why small, poor farmers should get less good information than big, rich ones. But the mechanisms of delivery have to be different. And again, there's a whole area of work that other people know much more about than I do. And there was a quote from the people in India who used the modelling and crop sensing. They said, well, that was fine, we did pretty well here, but we've now got to find practical ways that we'll get the same result, but without site-specific modelling and a minimum of crop monitoring. So I'm going to stop there. Sorry, it's been rushed. I do need to put an advert coming from the other side of the Atlantic. In 8 years' time, the British Society of Soil Science is hosting the World Soils Congress in Glasgow in Scotland, and I hope to see you there. Thank you.
Time for one question. One question. Time for one question.
I was hoping somebody else was going to do that. Under tropical conditions, we certainly find that it gets released quicker than under temperate, so that's what you might expect. But it may be that some clever sort of tillage methodology, there's good reasons for doing reduced till, but it's possible that a bit of deliberate tillage to stimulate decomposition could possibly work. But it's something I really don't know how you would do that, I'm afraid.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.